Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast 46. My name is Terry Frost, and this time we're going from 1936 to 2014. First off, we're going to look at the H.G. Wells adaptation from 1936 by William Cameron Menzies, Things to Come. And then we're going to the 21st century and the second decade therein with Lucy, the Luc Besson movie about transcendence and nootropic drugs and all sorts of things like that, starring Scarlett Johansson. So sit back, I'll get the contact deets out of the way, and we'll start talking film. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how is everybody going? The weather has got warm here, which is lovely. Spring has sprung. I spent yesterday at a friend's place with a spit roast barbecue of pork and chicken, and we ate food out al fresco under an enormous pine tree, and then we played some games of bocce and just basically shot the shit and caught up with each other and had a very lovely time. So I'm feeling very mellow, very sanguine, and very ready to talk about cinema. But first I'm going to be a little bit self-indulgent and talk about the death of one of Australia's most controversial but most influential prime ministers, Gough Whitlam. Gough was prime minister from 1972 to 1975, but he brought in a lot of things that are really important. Universal health care, he got Australia out of Vietnam, he gave 18-year-olds the vote, he made university free. He did a lot of other things which our current government's now trying to destroy, but which were very influential policies and which have had long-term positive effects on Australia. And he died at the age of 98, which is a pretty good run. Now, I met him when I was about 8 years old in a public park after a civic event, and he stopped and had a chat with me for a few minutes. And I always remembered that kind of kindness to me. There weren't any cameras around, there weren't any miners around or anything like that. He just stopped and had a chat. But this was in the early days when he was the opposition leader. So he was basically the opposition leader of the federal government. But he stopped to have a chat with me, and I met him again briefly when I was 18 years old and could vote for him in his last federal election. So he'll be missed. He really is an influential figure. He did a lot of support for the arts. A lot of the stuff we now know as exploitation was put in place partly because of the Whitlam government policies and the support given to movie production by his government. So he's definitely a figure to be remembered, and he will be missed. And he's very unlike modern politicians in that he had a vision for the future and had a way of communicating that to the public, which hasn't really been evident since then. But that's all I'm going to say on Gough. And now I'm going to talk about something a bit more prosaic, mundane, and not incredibly important to the universe, and that's the movies I've been watching since the last time I podcasted. There have only been a few of them, and they're not too bad. So basically I watched Funny Face, the Fred Astaire, Audrey Hepburn movie with lots of fashion stuff. It's very much a chick flick kind of thing, but I enjoyed it. I got a Blu-ray of it cheaply and decided to enjoy the full Technicolor wonderfulness of it. Lots of singing and dancing. Fred Astaire is way too old for Audrey Hepburn at the time, as everybody knows. But Stanley Donlan's direction's pretty good. And there were some really great scenes set in Paris, and that's always a big plus for me when I'm watching a movie. I did also see a movie from, I think it's about 1970, called Equinox, which basically, it's a little bit Cthulhu kind of stuff. It was done on a very small budget. One of the people who did it was Dennis Buren, who later went on to be very influential in the special effects work for the George Lucas Star Wars movies. But Equinox, yeah, there's a lot of stop motion stuff in there, and yeah, it wasn't a bad little effort. It started out as a student film, but then they went on and made a feature film of it. It's not really fantastically great, but it does have a couple of features of interest, one of which is Dennis Muren's work with the stop motion monsters. Even though they were crude at times, they did show the start of his special effects career. And the other thing is, one of the characters in it is played by a very famous and very well-regarded science fiction and fantasy author, being Fritz Leiber. He has a few scenes playing a professor. Doesn't really get to talk very much, but he's in there. And that makes it a little bit more interesting for people who are into the written side of science fiction. Now, for the radio gig, ABC Local Radio in Darwin, I did the gig this time around with Paul Serratore from Alice Springs, because Liz was still on holiday. And we decided to take a look at a couple of films, one of which has been released and one of which hasn't. We looked at Road Warrior, the second Mad Max film, starring Mel Gibson, of course, and Bruce Spence and Virginia Hay, all those kinds of people, and took a look at that as a piece of cinema. And then did a bit of a dissection about the new one, Fury Road, which is coming out, I think, in 2015, starring Tom Hardy. Now, we took a little bit of a nationalist line on that, because re-watching some of the Mad Max movies, there's a very Australian story there, and it's told from an Australian viewpoint with Australian characters to a great extent, less with Max than with the peripheral characters around him. And then suddenly they go off to Namibia and decide to make a Mad Max movie with an international cast and not too much in the way of Australianness to it. And that's a kind of disappointment to me, because one of the things I did appreciate about the Mad Max movies was they were telling a post-apocalyptic story for us, in a sense. And also it gave a certain strangeness to it for overseas audiences. Now it's just become a generic, big-budget action flick kind of thing. And so both of us were on the same page with that one, that we really would have rather have seen it told with an Australian actor playing Max, and there are a number of them who could, and also in Australian locations, because we've got some fantastic desert locations all across Australia, and they really did miss the opportunity to use them in this kind of a film. So Paul and I had a bit of a chat about that. And that's pretty much what I have been watching. Not a lot. I've been watching a bit of television. There's lots of episodic television genre stuff coming out at the moment. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is back. Person of Interest is back. I'm watching Arrow and The Flash to get a little bit of a DC geek thing happening there. And what I've actually been doing while exercising on the cross-trainer elliptical machine is episodes of Johnny Quest, the old 1960s Johnny Quest, not the revamped one they did in, I think, the 80s or the 90s, but old school Johnny Quest. I've been watching those episodes while exercising and really enjoying them. They're a lot of fun, and there's some very groovy kind of futuristic science stuff, which, of course, has been parodied by the Venture Brothers. But it's good to see the imagination that's been used in the old episodes of Johnny Quest and the fun of them. So I've been watching those as a little bit of a spur to get fit. So let's go from the 21st century first world problem of my fitness to a 1936 worldwide problem, being war. And the 1936 English film Things to Come. I'll play a bit of the trailer for the movie now, and then you've got to remember this is a 1936 trailer. It doesn't have "In a World" or anything cool like that to it. But I'll play it for you, and then we'll discuss why it's such an important and seminal science fiction movie in spite of some things which seem a little bit ropey to us now in the 21st century.
We live in interesting, exciting, and anxious times.
Be too sure of progress.
Well, what's going to stop progress nowadays?
War.
There is war and rumor of war.
The unknown aircraft passed over Sea Beach and dropped bombs. Chaps up to see me. They've got guts. They can do something still. We'll fight them. We'll fight them. You've still got hostages?
I've read of the Mediterranean and Greece and Egypt and India. Oh, I can read a lot of those old books. I'm not like most of the younger people here. I learned quite a lot before education stopped and schools closed down. I want to see the world.
If I had my way, you could fly to all that in a couple of hours.
If you were free. And if I was free?
Will this be humanity tomorrow? And the years after? What then?
2036 AD. You are catapulted through the centuries, whirled into the great unknown, into an era of glass cities towering to the sun, and a gigantic space gun rocketing passengers to the moon.
I don't believe my boy could have thought of this. The two of them must have got together.
They'll come back together. This time there's no attempt to land on the moon.
When is this great experiment made? How much longer have we got before they go?
When the space gun is ready.
Sometime this year, do you mean?
Soon.
Cabell, they're rioting. It's barbarism come back again.
If they smash up that infernal gun, then honor is satisfied and you needn't go.
They won't smash the gun.
Is man never to rest, never to be free, make the space gun the symbol of all that drives us, and destroy it now.
Okay, so this is a 1936 science fiction movie, an English one, produced by Alexander Corder and directed by William Cameron Menzies. The script was actually written by H.G. Wells himself, along with Lajos Biro, a Romanian emigre writer who did a lot of screenplays in the British film industry in the 30s and 40s. Things like The Private Life of Henry VIII with Charles Laughton, Private Life of Don Juan, The Scarlet Pimpernel, Sanders of the River, The Man Who Could Work Miracles, which was the other 1936 adaptation of some of H.G. Wells' work. Let's see, Night Without Armour, Four Feathers, The Thief of Baghdad, he worked on the screenplay for that. And a few other things. He died in 1948, but wasn't well for a time before his death. But he was a very influential screenwriter. Now, there's no underestimating how powerful a voice H.G. Wells was in a lot of ways in the first 40% of the 20th century. He obviously had written The Time Machine and a whole bunch of other stories like that, and War of the Worlds most influentially. And he did do a lot of talking about socialism and about techno-socialism and free love and all sorts of things. He was kind of like an all-round polymath go-to guy whenever anybody in the press wanted to have somebody talk about these kind of things. He was one of the very first futurists, in other words, and quite influential and well-respected for that. This movie is actually an adaptation of a very didactic work of his, The Shape of Things to Come, which he wrote in the late 1920s, I believe, talking about the future and about warfare and about how we can avoid warfare and the threat that war poses to civilization across the world. Obviously, he had lived through a couple of wars himself, the Boer War and the First World War. He wasn't in the military at all, but like anybody else in Europe at the time, these things had a profound effect on him, and he was trying to educate the world on how to avoid war. So the movie starts in 1944, years after it was released, in a place called Everytown, which really essentially is London. And it's Christmas time there. There's the threat of war, obviously, from Europe, because by 1936, Hitler had been in power for 3 years, so the people making this movie were well aware of the storm clouds on the horizon of Europe and the threat that that may pose to the future of civilization, or at least Western civilization. So during Christmas 1940, every town is bombed from Europe by a whole bunch of long-range bombers and pretty much smashed. And there's a montage of the war, which goes on until the late 1960s. So Wells's prediction, which turned out fortunately not to be true, was that World War II will continue to a greater or lesser rate until the 1960s. And there's a lovely montage of tanks across the battlefield, and then more futuristic tanks going across the battlefield, and then a retreat from technology, in a sense, as the resources are drained. The war becomes more and more low-tech, in a sense, until finally everybody's pretty much exhausted and civilization collapses into a dark age. So we take things up in 1970, where every town's being run by a guy called the Boss, played by Ralph Richardson in a very grand manner. He's trying to get the few remaining aeroplanes back up in the air so he can attack the people in the hills who have certain resources that he wants for his people. So the war itself hasn't become an international war anymore. It's been a local war between tribes, in a sense. And there's some lovely little bits and pieces here. There's a horse-drawn Rolls-Royce, which doesn't have any tires. It's just running on the rims. And the guy who owns it talked about it and how he really didn't think anything back in the old days of travelling 100 miles in the car. And now here it is, a kind of rusting wreck being drawn by a couple of large horses. So they've got that kind of little touches there. They've got a cobbler repairing shoes. They've got basically they've gone back to a kind of a very local and agrarian middle-aged society with the Boss as the king, in a sense. Now, the other problem they've got at the time, apart from the collapse of civilization, as if that were not enough, is a thing called the wandering sickness, which is almost like a zombie kind of thing where people get ill and just start walking around until they collapse and die. And, of course, by walking around, they spread the disease to other people. But by 1970, they've pretty much got that under control, even though it's killed half of the people in the world, mostly by shooting anybody who has the sickness who wanders towards the town. So basically through an enforced quarantine. So into this very cozy little dictatorial state comes a very large aeroplane piloted by Raymond Massey's character, Cabal, who has this groovy helmet, which is actually part of the cockpit of the plane. The cockpit and the helmet are the same thing, so they kind of does double duty there. And that's the iconic image that you'll see if you go to the website, martisdrivein.blogspot.com. There'll be a couple of images of it there by the time this comes out. And he comes in and tells them that there's a new state based in Basra in Iraq, which is a little bit ironic from our point of view, where his people, who are starting to rebuild a technological civilization, want to basically civilize the world. They're called the United Airmen, and their organization's called Wings Across the World. And he starts talking about some really interesting but really scary things, things like that he belongs to the Brotherhood of Efficiency and the Freemasonry of Science. And they have a thing called the Gas of Peace, which basically knocks everybody out and enables them to conquer various areas, even though it's not seen as a war. In a sense, what they're doing is conquering territory using this gas, which merely knocks people out. And this in itself raises one of the interesting quandaries with things to come. The civilization that rises up after the very long and apocalyptic war is in itself a kind of rationalist fascism. They believe in science and progress, which is all right for itself, but basically they're very kind of monocultural, and the only people you see in this brave new world, and this is probably a result of it being filmed in England at the time, are white people. So they have another montage where you see the rebuilding as a technological civilization of every town, most of it underground, so they can have green and pleasant lands above. And the montages in this are really good. The model works fantastic for the time, and they show people working with enormous machines and enormous factories. They're like a Hugo Gernsback magazine cover come to life. It's all done in an Art Deco style as well, so the future is very much in what William Gibson has called the Gernsback Continuum, with that kind of Art Deco-y future and people wearing tunics with wide shoulder protrusions and capes and things like that, and everybody is beautiful and wise and overwhelmingly white. So the civilization doesn't look bad. I mean, it looks like the kind of resort hotel in Shangri-La, in a sense. But it really does have that kind of, from our point of view at least, fascism about it, where, you know, the technological progress is all, the civilization is basically run by scientists, as opposed to Australia at the moment, where we don't even have a minister for science. But nonetheless, there is a kind of monoculture there and an assumption that peace and prosperity and technological progress come from everybody being on exactly the same page and doing exactly the same thing and having the same belief systems based on rationality, which, of course, is a contradiction in terms. But nonetheless, it's a slightly discomforting world they build, even though it is a pretty spectacular one. They have a very lovely, well-designed autogyro. They have an enormous space gun that they've created to launch a trip to the moon, which is the big end point of the movie. Of course, we all know from pretty much basic physics that you can't really launch a spaceship out of a space gun, because what you end up with is a very nice little expensive spaceship with a whole bunch of human paste sitting at the back wall of it. The accelerations necessary will be lethal to human life, but leaving that aside, basically two people go up into space in spite of the fact that a sculptor and humanist played by Sir Cedric Hardwicke implores everybody to just stop progress for a while and let us relax and enjoy our lives for a while. And to that end, he and his people form an enormous mob and start trying to attack the space cannon, which probably isn't the best way to go about things. But then he's a sculptor, he's not an engineer. So basically that's it. The story is 100 years of future history, in a sense, which is kind of a bold move for a 1936 movie to make. I'm just trying to think if there are any movies that do try to extrapolate a history 100 years in the future with a few stopping off points the way that this one does. Then there isn't really. I mean, you've got a little bit of it in The Time Machine in 1960, but I can't really think of any movie makers who have been bold enough to try to extrapolate a future. Maybe, I mean, Bicentennial Man did it around the turn of the century, the Chris Columbus movie, in a very limited kind of way. But it's not something we see a lot in science fiction films. We don't see that technological process of getting from here to there. I mean, yes, we've got a lot of movies that are set at a certain date in the future, but the movies aren't about how we get there. But this one definitely is, and it's a bold thing to do. The movie wasn't successful financially at all, but again, it has had a long and influential history as a part of the science fiction film genre. It really is an influential movie, and it is a gutsy thing to do. I mean, one of the things about a lot of these films is there wasn't really the inbuilt market that we now have for science fiction movies. People are craving things. Of course, the latest iteration of that, and being probably the most science fictional movie that Marvel has done yet, being the Avengers Age of Ultron, which the trailer for which has just come out. And people are really grooving on that. And it does show the dangers of technological progress, I suppose. But we, in 1936, we didn't really have a market for that. We had a lot of market for things like, well, talking at least the UK, Jesse Matthews musicals and George Formby musicals and Alfred Hitchcock melodramas and dramas and suspense movies and all those sorts of things. But science fiction wasn't really a big part of the scene in those days. And yet Corder and Wells, and Wells did have a lot of influence on the way the movie panned out. Corder, Alexander Corder, and not, I was going to say Orson Welles, and I was telling myself I wouldn't say Orson Welles, but I nearly did then. H.G. Wells really got together and created something that is unlike anything that had gone before or come since. One of the things that Welles really wanted to do, and which he was very strict on, was he wanted the movie not to look at all like Fritz Lang's Metropolis, which was the previous big science fiction movie showing a future, and even though it was 10 years before. And Welles really wanted to avoid it being compared to Metropolis because it's telling a very different story in a very different way. And so where there's a gothic and kind of almost medieval look to the cities in Metropolis in some ways, Corder and Welles and Biros really wanted to give it a more modernistic look. So it is very much an Art Deco future. But for me, the most interesting parts of the movie aren't the future where the guys go to space and everybody's walking around wearing tunics with capes on them and dressing pretty much the same and being monocultural and white. It's that middle bit after the fall of civilization where you've got Ralph Richardson's boss and his consort played by Margareta Scott. It's much more interesting where he's trying to bully the scientists who remain and the technicians and engineers who remain into bootstrapping civilization where they just don't have the resources to do so. And he just kind of gives them little homilies to try to egg them along, even though it's known that this really isn't going to happen without some kind of input of either resources or technical knowledge that they don't previously have. And when the plane comes down with Cabell in it and the boss captures him and uses him to try to increase the amount of technological knowledge that's in the town, that's where things get really interesting. And there is that bit in that trailer that I played where Margareta Scott is talking to Cabell about all the things she's read about the larger world and how she wants to be a part of it and how she wants to know about it and all of that kind of thing. And that is kind of interesting too, because it's not a boy or a man saying these things about wanting the future to be a better place and wanting to be able to explore the world and having, in spite of the difficulties, continued education. It's actually a female character, and I like that. There's not too much feminist in this movie, but the fact that Margareta Scott put herself towards her character, Rowena is her name, and it's not mentioned very much in the movie, so I just had to go and look it up. Rowena, the character, puts herself towards the center of power as it is in this kind of dark age every town. And that enables her to kind of learn things and to keep control over her life and the way the town works to a certain extent. And that's kind of interesting there, that the way to do it in that kind of medieval society, and of course in medieval societies as we know them, for women to have any power was to stay close to the men who had power. And it's interesting that they put that in there as a little bit in the movie. She's the only really strong female character in there, which is a bit of a shame, because I think that they've missed some opportunities there to kind of flesh things out a little more interestingly had they done that. But again, it's 1936, and they aren't as wise as we tell ourselves we are, for instance. But anyway, just to finalise things about things to come, it's got that beautiful look. There's some fantastic model work on there. There's some retro-futurism that's really eye-poppingly good, and remembering that cinema is about the images as much as it is about anything. I'll talk a bit more about that when I talk about Lucy in a moment. But it is the go-to science fiction movie, I think, for the 1930s. If you discard things like Frankenstein and the Universal horror stuff, this really is the kind of high point of 1930s science fiction cinema. Even though it's flawed, even though there's a fascist aspect to it, even though the future of it kind of posits is pretty much absurd from our point of view, the fact that Welles predicted World War II and predicted the London Blitz and also predicted what we now know as failed states, and to a big extent every town in 1970 in this movie, is what we would now consider a failed state. And there's looking at it from that point of view makes it a little more chilling and a little more close to home as well, because of course in our modern world we have a number of failed states, increasing numbers unfortunately, and that made it just that little more powerful thinking about it from that point of view. But I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back I'm going to talk about something just as interesting as Things to Come, and that is Luc Besson's 2014 science fiction movie of transcendence, Lucy, starring Scarlett Johansson.
Stand the sight of it and said, let's fly away. They took a look at a Western movie, somebody heard them say. If a horse can be a star, think how dumb the people are, we'd better fly away. Then they shook their little green antennas, scratched their purple hair. Said this planet is an awful menace. Let's go back to where we came from. Two little men in a flying saucer just didn't care to stay.
No, no.
Said it's too peculiar here. Headed for the stratosphere and quickly flew away.
Ebbets Field in Brooklyn when the Dodgers played a baseball game.
Hey! Heard all the screaming, said we must be dreaming, cause the planet is insane.
During their mission, heard a politician making speeches as they traveled by.
Gabble, gabble, gabble. But they departed faster than they started, cause the hot air blew them sky high.
Flew down to earth one day. Listened to a radio, saw a television show and said, let's fly away. They got their fill of commercial jingles and they were heard to say, all the people seem to be living in a nursery, we'd better fly away. Traveled all around and once they'd seen us, said let's head for space. We were better off on Mars and Venus.
Goodness, what a place to live in.
Two little men in a flying saucer just didn't care to stay.
No, no.
Crossed a crowded thoroughfare,
saw the hats the women wear,
and quickly flew. One look and then they flew away.
Little man in a flying saucer. Little man in a flying saucer.
That was Ella Fitzgerald with Two Little Men in a Flying Saucer. I just thought I'd get it a bit whimsical there. You've got to like that song, otherwise ISIL wins. So on we go to the second half of Martian Drive-In Podcast. See, I made myself sound like I was clones there. I'm going to do it again. You ready? The movie I'm about to talk about is Luc Besson's Lucy from 2014. I should do an entire podcast as clones, but I don't think I will because it would be way too much effort. Anyway, here's the trailer from Lucy, and after that I'll start talking about it.
What happened? What did you do to my stomach?
What's going on?
We've merely slipped a new package into your lower tummy.
And you're going to transport something very special to us.
No.
You speak English?
Yes.
Take me to the hospital now.
Hospital.
Somebody put a bag of drugs inside me. I need you to take it out. It's leaking.
It is estimated most human beings only use 10% of the brain's capacity. Imagine if we could access 100%. Interesting things begin to happen. Yes?
Professor Norman, my name's Lucy. I just read all your research on the human brain. It's a little rudimentary, but you're on the right track.
Thank you.
I have access to 28% of my cerebral capacity.
I can feel every living thing.
Since when did you start writing Chinese?
Since an hour ago.
What happens when she reaches 100%?
I have no idea.
All this knowledge, you can unlock secrets that go beyond our universe. I'm not even sure that mankind is ready for it.
It's like all things that make me human are fading away.
Okay, Lucy's a 2014 French science fiction action film written and directed by Luc Besson, the guy who gave us movies like Leon, The Professional, The Fifth Element, and any number of other ones, the Transporter movies, Taken. He's great with action, and he's also got another parallel line with action science fiction movies, which is kind of interesting. It stars Scarlett Johansson, Morgan Freeman, Amir Waked, and Choi Min-sik. I'm reading this from Wikipedia, by the way. Johansson portrays the title character, a woman who gains psychokinetic abilities from a nootropic drug being absorbed into her bloodstream. And I'll just do a little bit of the start of the film from the Wikipedia thing, because it's pretty good. Lucy is a 24-year-old American woman living and studying in Taipei, Taiwan. She is tricked into working as a drug mule by her new boyfriend, whose employer, Mr. Zhang, is a Korean mob boss and drug lord. Lucy delivers a briefcase to Mrs. Zhang containing a highly valuable synthetic drug called CPH4. After seeing her boyfriend shot and killed, she is captured and a bag of the drug is forcibly sewn into her abdomen and that of three other drug mules who will also transport the drug for sale in Europe. While Lucy is in captivity, one of her captors kicks her in the abdomen, breaking the bag, releasing a large quantity of the drug into her system. As a result, she begins acquiring increasingly enhanced physical and mental capabilities, such as telepathy, telekinesis, mental time travel, and she can choose not to feel pain or other discomforts in addition to other abilities. She kills off her captors and escapes. So that's the start of the film. Now, this is the second Scarlett Johansson movie, the second Luc Besson movie I've done, the Martian Driving podcast. And actually, it's the third Luc Besson movie, Adele Blanc-Sec, Fifth Element, in this one. And I like them. I like the fact that he comes from a different viewpoint than American filmmakers. Now, I'll get the elephants in the room out of the way first before I start waxing lyrical about this one. The thing about people only using 10% of their brain capacity, I'm pretty sure Besson was aware of that when he made the movie. But that trope and that kind of myth about how our brains function is really, really useful in this movie because it offers a countdown to her transcendence. So various times during the movie, you see what percentage of her brain capacity Lucy is able to access and use. And that then reveals new aspects to her abilities and new ways for her to get through the things she's got to get through to survive and to also attain 100% capacity and eventually transcendence from a physical form. So it's really, really useful in the context of the film. Now, one of the other things that Besson does, which is kind of interesting, is he uses animal imagery to describe various things that are going on. Now, some people see this as kind of very literalist and simplistic, but I kind of liked it. Well, he mentions predators and prey and then cuts to some wildlife footage of leopards and cheetahs attacking antelopes and things like that. So he's doing some interesting things with visual storytelling here. I don't think it's always really successful, but I do like the fact that he's tried to tell the story in a different way. And the other thing about this too is people have compared it to a number of other movies, 2001, Tetsuo the Iron Man, Limitless, where Bradley Cooper takes a nootropic drug and attains certain abilities. The Matrix, of course, and even Tree of Life, the Malick movie. So it's been compared to a lot of other things, but I think it's kind of stands on its own too. It tells a lot of the same stories, but there are a few things that Besson does that's really interesting. First off, he's got a female protagonist. Lucy's a bit of a fuck up. She's got a drug dealer boyfriend. Her studies in Taipei aren't going very well, which she conveyed during a phone conversation with her parents, which was really interesting. And she's basically one of those people that's on a downward spiral in her life. But suddenly she gets into this horrible situation, which is intensely scary. Her encounters with the drug lord, Mr. Zhang, who's played by Choi Min-sik. And you might remember that name because Choi Min-sik was the guy who starred in Old Boy, the Korean action film directed by Chan Wook Park. Not, of course, the stupid Spike Lee American remake starring Josh Brolin. But anyway, he brings a lot to his crime lord. He's speaking in Korean all through the movie. He doesn't speak English. And various people in various ways have got to translate for him in his encounters with Lucy. Originally, when she delivers the drugs to him in the building where he is. And later on, when she becomes a drug mule, and afterwards, when she goes out to get more of the drug, which is required for her to attain the goals that she sets herself in the film. And he is really great in this. Rather than being an alienating thing, the subtitled Korean that he speaks in the movie kind of makes it really work and grounds a lot of the interactions between Lucy, the character, and Mr. Zhang in reality. This movie's got a very international point of view. It was filmed in Taipei and Paris and New York City, and so it's got a kind of global outlook. I mean, a lot of these movies about transcendence and things, particularly the movie called Transcendence, in fact, are set in a fairly geographically limited area, whereas this one does have a global sensibility. Obviously, events in the movie are going to eventually have a very wide global impact. And the fact that Lucy, of necessity, has to travel from Taipei to Paris and then travels on to New York really help underline this in a lot of ways. Now, of course, you've got Morgan Freeman in there playing the scientist that Lucy goes to for assistance and to explain herself in some ways. It's a little bit of kind of simplistic casting in a way. Morgan Freeman's always playing the wise man these days in movies, or when he doesn't play the master criminal, he's playing wise guys, and he does a pretty good job in this one. I think that it would have been interesting getting someone a bit different. I like Morgan Freeman in a lot of things, but I think the casting was too obvious for me. Would have been interesting getting maybe a European actor of whom we know a lot less in anglophonic cinema to play, because there would have been any number of people who could have done the job. But given the fact that this movie was obviously made for box office success, having no names apart from Scarlett Johansson, it was a useful thing. And the budget of it was $40 million US, and it made so far $415 million. So when Luc Besson went fishing with this one, he definitely got his bait back. But some things I like about it. I like Luc Besson's action cinema because I think that he's one of the great creatives of action cinema, along with people like John Woo, from whom we haven't heard a lot lately, and other people. He does have a very good way of telling a story visually and through action rather than words. Though there are some nice words in this. There's a phone conversation with Lucy as she begins to access more and more of her intellectual capacity between herself and the character playing her mother, where she says things like she can remember the taste of her mother's breast milk and stuff like that. There's a real kind of eeriness about that conversation and a number of the other things that she does and says in the movie, which takes us out of the ordinary. I really think that Besson as a writer is on his A game with this film. I'm not saying it's perfect by any means, but it's really, really interesting. And I think of all the recent movies covering nootropics and human transcendence, either through technology or drugs and things like that. This is probably the most interesting one. People have compared it to 2001, but I found 2001 dull and slow, even when I first saw it. Yeah, the visuals are very pretty, and the psychedelic light show was very pretty, but I think it's 45-minute television episode stretched out to feature length. But this one is kind of the reverse 2001 in some ways. It's a fast, action-packed movie, which, again, does go cosmic at various stages and has a little bit of an homage to 2001, which the name of the title character in this film gives a little bit of a hint to. There's also a really good tension in the movie. At the start, Lucy is way out of her depth and her life is threatened on a regular basis. Every couple of minutes there's a new threat to her life and her existence. And when she is eventually cut open and used as a drug mule, she's chained up against a wall until she's ready to go. And there's also that sense of sexual menace as well, without it being prurient at all. There's that underlining bit in there of the threat of physical violence against her and the threat of sexual assault and the threat of her losing her life. And Johansson plays that really well. I think that from being a not-too-impressive actress in things like Ghost World to now really coming, hitting her stride and learning her craft, she makes a kind of slacker character of Lucy at the start of the film really believable and inhabits the role really well. The boyfriend, who doesn't last very long, I'll give you that much of a spoiler, is kind of abusive, and she just takes it because, you know, she just can't care enough to get herself out of the situation. But as things escalate from there, she learns who she is and kind of gets her shit together and rewrites her software as well as her hardware in some interesting ways there. And, I mean, of course, that's the arc of a movie like Limitless as well with Bradley Cooper. He starts out as a slacker kind of character and gets this nootropic drug and starts to pull himself together and get his shit together. But there's a point at which in Limitless it stops. But in this one, there are no brakes on it. It's a continuing escalation there, where first she accesses her own brain, then she accesses other things, and then she learns to control the environment around her. And it's the special effects, which are, for this kind of movie, kind of sparing, really back that up too. The special effects were done for this film by ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, and they're kind of a little bit different than anything you've seen before. One of the things the guys did work with was finding different ways of showing what they show in the film, the effects work and the way that things change under her influence. That's really, they really did try to make it look a little bit different from the stuff of a similar kind that you've seen before, and I think that works as well. It's got music by a collaborator of Besson's for a long time, Eric Serra, which underlines the action really nicely without overwhelming it. It doesn't draw attention to itself, but it supports what's going on. And there are a number of kind of action set pieces in this film which work really well. They're the kind of things that are familiar to people who know of Luc Besson's previous work in action cinema. But they really do lift it to an interesting level by having it be a female character doing it, which kind of harks back a little bit to Leon the Professional and Natalie Portman's character in that. And there's a really interesting phase shift at one point where from being a victim who is trying to escape and kind of, you know, work out what's happening and survive in a sense, there's a point at which the arc of the character does not become that. The arc of the character then becomes one of learning and discovery, which I kind of like there. Lucy is learning how her first her mind, then her body, then the world around her, then the universe work, and it becomes a voyage of discovery rather than just survival. And the things she has to do to survive, the things, the people who try to attack her, most of whom belong to Mr. Zhang, are more an annoyance at one stage. They're insects buzzing around her head rather than a mortal threat to her. And that's an interesting kind of path to take, and it's done in a very cool way. Scarlett Johansson's on the screen most of the time in this movie and does a really good job of it too. There's a little bit of her Avengers character, the Black Widow, in it, but there's enough difference there to kind of mark it as totally separate character and not just another iteration of the same character. Now, you've got to remember, this is a Luc Besson movie. It's not going to be terribly deep, and it's not going to be one of those ones that you think about for days and days afterwards, but it's a good roller coaster ride of a film. And one of the things that surprised me by the time I finished watching it was how well they did that transcendence to almost a godlike status. It's not clumsy at all, and it's not cautious or tentative. Besson just gets it done and does it in some interesting ways. But while not leaving everybody else behind, that's the other interesting thing, because there's a bit at the end of the film where Lucy says a couple of things that are really interesting, and it shows that one of the reasons why I like the writing in this film. At one stage, Lucy says that the point of life is to pass on knowledge, which I felt is kind of cool because that's what I do with podcasts. It's what I do with my work, and it's a kind of very much a guiding principle for me in a lot of the things I do around the place. So I'm on board with that one right from the start. And the other cool thing with the transcendence of her to something and somewhere else is she says, life was given to us a billion years ago. Now you know what to do with it. And that's kind of cool too. One of the things she does towards the end of the film is pass on that knowledge. So she passes the knowledge on to the Morgan Freeman character in a kind of prosaic but interesting way, and kind of gives a gift to humanity, which leads to the possibility of a sequel. And there is still talk around of doing a sequel to this movie. It is a film that could really... There's more to say there, and there's more interesting places they could go with it if they chose to do so. And also, now you've got this drug out CPH4, which is actually a real hormone that human beings have in them. You have CPH4 as a kind of nootropic drug, and if it's being synthesized, you can take the story into different directions using that. And the use of nootropic drugs as one of the plot engines in this story also gives a little bit of a cyberpunk feel, along with the initial setup in Taipei. You've got that kind of Asian cyberpunk feel about it as well. You've got some intimations of nanotechnology in there. And it's just a nice ride. I think a lot of people have been critical about it. It's split people two ways. People either like this movie a lot or they don't like it very much at all. But I find it a lot more approachable and a lot more interesting and, dare I say it, fun than a lot of the science fiction movies that have come out lately. It's well, it's an entertainment, and that's never a bad thing for a movie to be. Movies that do try to treat, you know, cosmic themes like this, they're a bit like movie Transcendence being obvious, the obvious one there. They're kind of heavy and portentous, and they take themselves way too seriously. And they're weighed down by that self-imposed seriousness, and the way that the movie and the movie makers regard what they're doing really does mean that they don't fly very well. So just to summarize this one, I love the international nature of the film, the fact that it's a French director, an American star, a Korean co-star. It's filmed across Asia, Europe, and the Americas. And I like the fact that it does go cosmic without boring me. I mean, 2001 bored me. I found Transcendence boring as well. But the visual storytelling that Luc Besson brings to the movie really does take the audience along with them. Yes, there are a couple of points where the kind of nature wildlife footage that's spliced into it gets a little bit obvious, but I don't mind that particularly. I think that what Besson's doing there is playing with things and trying to say things in a different way, and I admire that. I admire people who try to do things differently and who don't really, who set themselves up for the possibility of failure by being audacious rather than setting themselves up for failure by being too timid in the way that they make a film. And this one really does do that. It's bold, it's over the top, it's silly at times, but it tells a bloody good story, and that's never a bad thing at all. And, of course, it has that trademark Luc Besson action thing where basically in any Luc Besson movie that's action-based, there are going to be some things in there where you go, what the fuck, and then just go for the ride with them. And this is no exception to that. It's a good, honest piece of science fiction action cinema. It's not to be taken as a kind of hard science thing at all. You can pick apart the science in this movie fairly easily, as indeed a number of people already have. But in spite of that, because it generates such goodwill in the way it does it, you can forgive the thing like the 10%. And that's pretty much all people... There are two things I've heard people complain about this film. The first one was the 10% of our brain capacity trope. That's one thing. But it's useful for the storytelling, so we'll allow Luc Besson that. The other thing is the fact that Lucy walks around in high heels at various times. But from my point of view, I don't mind that so much. I'm not a big fan of high heels at the best of times, but if you're able to control your body and your mind to the extent that this character can, I think balancing on a pair of high heels isn't really going to be a difficult task for you. It's going to be dead easy. So given in the context of the movie, the high heels bit really isn't going to affect the character. So do I recommend the film? Yeah, I recommend the film. I recommend pretty much any Luc Besson film, even with things that are a bit, you know, not fantastically good of his, and there are only a few of those. They're always an entertainment, they're always a bit of fun, and they're always unlike the films of other people, which increasingly in these days of commercialization of cinema and homogenization of cinema, people who do things a bit differently are to be commended just for the very fact of it. But yeah, it's a good little film. It's a lot of fun, and I don't mind it at all. I'm getting it on Blu-ray when it comes out, and I really want to have it as part of my collection. So I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to see if I've got any feedback.
The distant future, the distant future.
It is the distant future, the year 2000.
We are robots.
The world is very different ever since the robotic uprising of the mid-90s. There is no more unhappiness.
Affirmative.
We no longer say yes. Instead, we say affirmative.
Yes, affirmative.
Unless it's a more colloquial situation with a few robo-friends. There is only one kind of dance. The robot.
And the robo-boogie.
Oh, yes. Two kinds of dances.
Finally, robotic beings rule the world.
The humans are dead.
The humans are dead. We use poisonous gases. And we poison their asses.
The humans are dead.
He's right, they are dead.
Humans are dead.
They look like they're dead.
It had to be done.
I'll just confirm that they're dead.
So that we could have fun.
Affirmative. I poked one, it was dead.
Can't we just talk to the humans? A little understanding could make things better. Can't we talk to the humans that we're together now?
No, because they are dead.
Binary solo.
0000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000
okay? The humans are dead.
Once again, without emotion,
the humans are dead. That was Flight of the Conchords with The Humans Are Dead. And we don't have any feedback, though. I do have a kind of indirect feedback. Last time around did the Outer Limits episodes of Harlan Ellison, and a day after I did it, we found out that Harlan had a stroke. Now, this continues the paleo cinema curse of talking about people in movies and TV shows just before they drop off the twig. Now, there's no indication yet that Harlan's going to drop off the twig anytime soon, but it does continue the curse where my voice on the internet has the ability to end and alter people's lives. So be nice to me. That's about it this time around on that very threatening and, again, transcendent note. Please send some feedback. Didn't get any this time, apart from Harlan having a stroke. So you can send it to cultguru@gmail.com. So I will leave you now with the podcast credits. And to get onto the podcast credits, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/paleocinema and become a financial supporter of the podcast. You can do it for $1 a month, which is very, very little in most parts of the world. And you get to be a part of this thing. So anyway, take care of yourselves. Keep watching the skies. And I will be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I'll be back in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. So take care of yourselves and I'll talk to you then. And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matomatic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.